clouds are really cheap. The way I seen them through the ports, of which there is a half a dozen on the base of my resorts. You wouldn't think I'd have too many, since I never cared for sports. But I'm never really lonely in my eccentrical port. There's always Cola Plankton. Him and me can play the blues. And then I'll watch him buff that tiny ruby that he used. He'll straighten up his turban and eject the little ooze along a one-celled Hammond organism underneath my shoes. And then I'll call Pup Tentacle. I'll ask him how's his chin. Find out how the future is, because that's where he's been. His little feet got long and flexible, and suckers fell right in the time he crossed the line from later on the way back when.
You're listening to KRFB, Radio Free Moscow. The time is 4:02.
Well, there's the Wild Clearwater Country Show coming right up.
Well, a quick weather update for you. If you live on the Palouse, tonight chance of rain.
As if we didn't know, huh?
Yeah. Chances just seem to increase throughout the day tomorrow. Looks like heavy rain tomorrow into Thursday night, and then clearing the end of the week. Highs in the 50s, lows mid-30s.
Okay, so we might even get a little snow down here if it rain at night, though
yeah.
It may melt during the day.
Yeah.
It's starting to be that time of year.
Yeah. Well, a couple quick announcements.
Well, we got a bunch of them, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Let's see. This Saturday, 7 p.m. at the American Legion Hall in Moscow. That's near East City Park, 317 South Howard Street. Uniontown. Rock and roll from Moscow. Rock and roll on the Palouse.
Mm-hmm.
They're having a benefit concert for Friends of the Clearwater, and they have a couple of fantastic little friends opening for them. Avery Jekyll and the Friends of the Trees.
Yeah, Avery's one about 5-6 years old, so she's...
Yeah, her public debut, maybe. Maybe not.
Maybe.
We don't know.
It's...
That's at 7 p.m. at the American Legion Hall mm-hmm. in downtown Moscow.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, of course, on Friday... night, KRFP, this radio station's fundraiser.
That's right.
And we played a little announcement promo about that before. But that's at the 1912 building on 3rd Street, just across from the high school. That ought to be a great event. Music as well. Blues band and acoustic wave machine. So everybody be there. This is going to be a nice weekend for fundraising.
Yeah, it should be. And a good reason to get out and just enjoy yourself and dance those rainy blues away, maybe. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you don't have the lack of daylight blues yet, because we're just getting started.
Yeah, we're just beginning into this
Larry McLeod season. Would have, Lorenzo Trout would have a couple hundred days ready to tick off of his list of dark days.
Mm-hmm.
He would count the days until...
he's in a slightly sunnier place, and we say slightly.
It's a little drier, probably.
A little bit drier over there.
Yeah. Well, today we'll be giving a few news updates, Gary.
Yes, we're going to do some news updates. We've got three or four of them here.
And then we're going to talk about a species probably known by most folks, a species that has a long history with people.
Yes, it does, and it's very interesting.
Been studied by people, been
noticed.
Yes, been noticed by an awful lot of folks for many, many years. Lots of great stories have come out of this species' existence, and
we may broaden it a bit to include a couple of its cousins.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
A family affair today.
Yes, we are.
Well, Gary, should we start with some news?
Let's start with a little bit of announcement and some news. Probably heard it on the Wild Clearwater Country Show, but several organizations had filed to list the recently rediscovered giant palouse earthworm as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. They just got word that the emergency listing would not be processed. The Fish and Wildlife Service said they didn't have, with no reason, said they didn't have any reason to list it, even though this petition was many pages long and cited several citations. But they did say this year they're going to be looking at it as a regular listing. Now, this was, I believe, recently found over in near the Magpie Forest, I guess, over Washington, an area owned, I believe, by Washington State University. Isn't that right?
That's right. For Earth Day last year, they took control and to preserve that chunk of land that a student group had been working for so long to do. So
And I think that's
April Overly, if you're out there.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. So that's an interesting news announcement. You'll probably be hearing more about the giant palouse earthworm, this great 3-foot-long pink earthworm that smells pretty like lilies. Oh, boy. In the future. Prior to that, the last, I think, known sighting was, I believe, about 8-10 years ago. Here near Moscow, along near Wallen Road, which is east of town, sort of on the flanks of Moscow Mountain. Everybody, I think, knows that if you're heading out toward, past the Slurp and Burp, you know, and that new interchange we have out there, then you just keep
roundabout.
On. The roundabout,
we're,
or whatever that
we're
thing is.
Civilized around
Yes, we
here.
Are. Boy, a little bit of Europe right here in Moscow, Moscow itself. Yes, yeah, so you head out east there as you're heading to Robinson Park. There's a fork in the road before you get to the park, about a mile, I guess, before the park. And the right fork is Wallen Road, and the left fork takes you up to the park itself. And so it was out way out beyond somewhere on Wallen Road, as I believe some University of Idaho researchers found it about 8-10 years ago, sometime in the 90s, I'm not sure. But you'll be hearing more about this, and I think we'll probably have a little segment and talk to some of the petitioners and get some information for that petition. The Palouse Prairie Foundation, I believe the Audubon Society, Friends of the Clearwater, along with some individuals, David Hall, Steve Paulson, and Lynn Nelson, a wildlife expert and veterinary professor at Washington State University, were all, I think, co-petitioners. There may have been some others that I missed, and if I did, I apologize. But that'll be a very interesting bit of news. Get a little update kind of where that is.
Yeah, and just to provide a little perspective, I think, on that species, it's not every day you rediscover a species. And the papers picked up, a lot of papers and a lot of press picked up on this story, and I believe I heard an estimate of the number of hits on the Palouse Prairie Foundation website increased by orders of magnitude the weeks following that announcement in the newspapers, including from a lot of folks from within the both houses of Congress.
Wow.
Back east. You know, this is a pretty big deal. I read in the newspaper the past couple of days a new bird species discovered in India, a new mouse species has been the word discovered loosely because a lot of biochemical research leads to the discovery.
Right.
It's just realizing that two populations are actually distinct enough to call them separate species.
Right.
But just knowing that this creature, the giant palouse earthworm, is still alive, that is great news.
That is great news.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some hope for the palouse.
That's right.
One of the most altered. In fact, I think in the lower 48 states, it is the most altered ecosystem we have. Hmm. The Palouse Prairie is the, I think, rarest. I think it's less than 1% of its former, what it was formerly in a natural or even semi-natural state. Most of it is now, you know, wheat fields and lentil fields.
Yeah, that's right.
Or cities. Another little bit of news information. Some organizations, I think led by Sierra Club and the Unitarian Church, also supported by Friends of the Clearwater, are going to be, I think they've sent a letter to the city of Moscow trying to join a campaign across the nation. Many cities are joining what is called the Cool Cities Initiative, trying to voluntarily reduce greenhouse gas emissions, a very, very important issue. And since the federal government has completely dropped the ball, fumbled the ball, many states and local municipalities are taking up, because most citizens in this country, as polls suggest, wanted the U.S. to sign the Kyoto Accords, even though those accords probably don't go far enough and are not strong enough. They were stepping in the right direction, and this administration wouldn't even support that very beginning step to begin dealing with this profound issue that could have extreme effects on humans here in the future. So that's some good news.
Very good.
A little
news.
Bit of a news announcement there.
Yeah.
Well, Will, I guess we can probably get into our show, unless you had some music you wanted to play before
yeah,
we
get into
right
a little music.
Into the heart of it. And I think maybe we can play a few songs later on that might be a little bit topical about our subjects, which we will announce when we come back.
Somebody sing, hello, hello, hello. Somebody sing. Somebody cries, why, why? Somebody sing. Somebody sing, hello, hello, hello. Somebody sing. Somebody cries, why, why? Somebody sing.
Yeah. Somebody sing. Somebody cries. Why? Somebody sing. Somebody cries. Why? Kulumani singanzenjani bayajabula basithanda yo.
All right, welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. That was Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
All right.
Well, should we reveal
the family?
Yeah. Today we'll be talking about the corvids.
Corvids.
The crows and jays.
That's right. And especially the biggest, largest member of that family. Popular in myth, stories, legends, and poems.
That's right.
The big corvid, the raven.
The raven.
There we go. It's kind of a good time of year to talk about ravens. This is the fall, I think.
It is. I watched them dancing over, what do they call it, Steakhouse Ridge this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Doing their acrobatics.
All right.
They're a pretty amazing bird.
Yeah, very... very smart.
They are.
And a generalist. And interestingly enough, they've adapted well here in the West to humans in recent times with a measure of protection. Actually, their numbers had declined until, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 years ago. And now they've increased. In fact, especially in some desert areas, they are starting to show up in places where they didn't before because humans have developed water. And let water out, and so they can actually now survive in desert areas where they were pretty much restricted around springs and water sources.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those situations where you can't quite say or justify or resolve in your mind if you think this is a good bird or a bad bird, because they have been so successful now.
Yes.
And as Gary said, in the West, in some places, their populations have increased 600%. The Intermountain West.
Amazing.
And one of the main reasons is their nesting habitat in some areas, including parts of Idaho, is primarily power poles. The tops of telephone poles.
That's an interesting.
Are often, more often than not, their nesting habitat as a preference over more natural habitats.
Very, very fascinating.
Yeah.
So they, and being somewhat of a generalist in at least their food habits, when you look at all the corvids, in fact, are their bills are shaped in such a way that they can take advantage of many different types of foods. Everything from fresh meat to carrion, which we often associate them with, to fruits and everything else. So they're very generalist in their feeding habits, and as such, they tend to be quite an intelligent bird. When you have an omnivorous kind of animal that can eat a lot of things, they have to be able to distinguish, good things from bad things. So be very adaptable in obtaining food. So.
They tend that sounds to be like another species I know.
Yeah, another one. In fact, there is a book about that other species, about its very eating habits, called The Omnivore's Dilemma. Good book by Michael Pollan about us and our eating habits as humans. So,
yeah, interesting. Ravens, I was thinking a little bit about this earlier, and I haven't fleshed it out in my head, Gary, so maybe you can help me. They are the largest of the songbirds. They are considered a songbird.
That's right. They're a perching bird.
That's right. They're a perching bird.
Passerines, I guess.
Formerly considered to be migrants, and some ravens do some migrating, though their migrations aren't nearly as pronounced as most or many other songbirds.
Mm-hmm.
They are the largest of the songbirds, and I find that interesting, just that law of nature that somehow dictates... for example, how large the largest mammal would get on land versus water, or how large perhaps the largest songbird will get and how small the largest, or how small the smallest raptor would get, for example. And just the overlap between those groups, I think, is pretty interesting. But they are considered a passerine, a songbird. And if you listen to them, they have a pretty amazing repertoire of vocalizations.
They do. I mean, mostly what we hear is the, which I can't do very well, and so I apologize. It would be nice to have a better at doing that, but the
Yeah, they
really
do.
The throat is kind of a caw.
Yeah, and they do. They have a pretty incredible kind of croaky trill that they do in flight, especially doing some of their more acrobatic displays.
But they're not limited to that sound. I mean, that's one we mostly hear and associate with them, but they're not limited to that sound, are they, Will?
No, they have quite a few different vocalizations. And they have some vocalizations that are very similar to that of their close cousin, the crow.
Oh.
Very similar in nature, and the quickest way to tell those two species apart, if you are seeing a large black bird that could be hawk-sized, it could be a crow when you first saw it, it helps to get underneath of it or above it, which is a little bit more difficult. But if you're underneath and can see the shape of that tail, it's wedge-shaped. Crows' tails are cut off straight across the back, squared off, and ravens are wedge-shaped tails.
That's right, and that is a good diagnostic characteristic.
Another thing about ravens that's interesting, just getting into a little bit of ecology, and we're going to spend some time talking about their habits, and then a little bit later we're going to talk about our relationship, our being humans' relationship with them, and some of the stories and legends that have come about because of our observations and experiences with the raven. They tend to nest in an open cup-shaped nest. They often compete with raptors for nest sites, owls and hawks, especially Buteos, the red-tailed and Swainson's hawks around here. Red-tails this time of year, Swainson's hawks in the summer. Mm-hmm. But they are direct competitors with red-tailed hawks for nests, and often a red-tail will usurp the nest of the common raven, sometimes having the effect of knocking nestlings flying or eggs flying, or they do have some very strong competition with other birds for nest sites. So they'll nest at the top of a tree. They prefer cliffs as well, and as we mentioned earlier, they'll nest on power poles in the tundra. They'll tend to look for cliffs as well along river banks. They seem to prefer areas with a good view. So they really do have a lot in common with the humans. They tend to be in areas of high elevation. As Gary mentioned earlier, they did suffer serious decline the first half of the century and plus. And I think a lot of that was probably due to human direct killing by humans because of perceived threats to stock and or crops.
Mm-hmm.
But in the east, they tend to be found along the mountaintops. They're more widely distributed in the west, but they do also tend to prefer high elevation areas. Some interesting facts about the common raven. If you've seen them do their acrobatics in flight, and they tend to have a great variety of vocalizations, and I can't describe them very well. I'm sorry, so I won't. But they are known to be acrobatic and do somersaults and make rolls in the air. And a couple observations have even noted that they've seen ravens flying upside down for as far as a kilometer.
Wow.
That just kind of blew my mind.
We have to pause here, Will, just for one very quick story. One of the most amazing acrobatic events I saw involved two ravens and an osprey in the wild country of the Upper Yellowstone River, which is the farthest place one can get away from a road in the lower 48. It's not as large as the big roadless chunk of land that we know as the Frank Church Wilderness and surrounding areas. But this area is a little rounder in shape, so it's actually, to get to the interior, you have further to go than you do to the more oval-shaped Frank Church large wild land block. But this southeast corner of Yellowstone, I was back there, oh, this has been now about, oh boy, it's almost 20 years ago now, Will. And I saw an osprey had caught a fish in the Yellowstone River. This is above Yellowstone Lake. We're way back in there. And these two ravens wanted to steal this fish. And they went after this, and they were doing these acrobatics. One would actually fly upside down and try to grab the fish right out of the talons of the osprey. And this osprey then also engaged in acrobatics, and it tumbled, and so did the ravens. And it changed the fish. Actually, in midair, the osprey put the fish from one set of talons, like its left one to its right ones, and they did these tumblings and dives and climbs and all this stuff, and it went on for a couple, 3-4 minutes, and then finally the osprey took off and the ravens finally gave up. But it was the most amazing acrobatic display I'd ever seen. These birds tumbling and flying, just like you said, upside down. Amazing.
Wow, that is amazing. Yeah. They one of the reasons that they may have been persecuted by farmers and folks who tend sheep, especially, is they tend to use and seem to prefer sheep wool to line the nest and to cover their eggs.
Okay.
So their tendency to fly close to the flock might not be for food after all. And it is interesting to note that they have had a pretty negative effect on some other species, especially in places where they didn't used to occur, like
Mojave
Gary
Desert.
Mentioned earlier, the Mojave Desert, the desert tortoise. Mm-hmm. They've started to have a pretty significant impact on desert tortoise.
Reproduction in particular, from the young ones, yeah.
In coastal areas, they've impacted least terns by robbing nests, and in the northwest, seabird colonies have been impacted by the raven. They've made it out into the Bering Sea following those big trawlers, and will pick off the seabirds or their eggs on the cliff faces. So they're a very opportunistic species.
There we go.
Yeah. Well, Gary? Should we go into some of the...
I think we ought to talk a little bit about some of the, before we go into more natural history. Do you want to talk some about the associations that people have had with ravens?
Yeah, let's do that.
And of course, some of the ecology with other creatures. Ravens, ravens, and other animals have been kind of long associated, especially here in North America. Been some studies: ravens and wolves, ravens and other animals that might want carrion, like a grizzlies, which often, if wolves have killed something and they leave for a bit, a grizzly bear may show up. So there's some very interesting interactions there that do go on, and observations. And now that wolves have been reintroduced into Yellowstone Park, a lot of the studies have been taking place there. But also, there's been some studies up in Minnesota there, and looking at some of those interactions. Fascinating, but ravens and crows, you know, these very intelligent birds, go back a long time with, in their association with humans. I think we sort of see ourselves in them a lot. We give them human attributes because we can't quite figure out if they're a good bird or a bad bird, because they're very opportunistic, just like we are. They tend to be greedy, just like we can be, or we think that. They tend to play tricks. And there's another animal, of course, here in North America that they're also associated with, and in fact, the kind of interchangeable with, and that's coyote, the coyotes. So they're considered a trickster, and especially this is very interesting among a lot of the native people in further west, kind of the West Slope Cascade, western British Columbia region, and maybe southeast Alaska. Actually, the raven replaced coyote as the main trickster in a lot of their mythology, although there were some stories, in fact, there's some stories about both trying to trick each other, but raven held a more prominent role, and in fact, Raven, a different incarnation of Raven, not as a trickster Raven, but as maybe the all-powerful Raven, was the creator of land and a place for humans to be, because the Raven, in some of the stories, used to live in the bird land or the spirit world, because birds can fly. And obviously, you know, when early humans could see birds fly, that was a pretty amazing thing, because, you know, we haven't been able to do that and still can't without, you know, aid of our machines and whatnot. And it's only been the last few, you know, a few decades that we could actually fly as, you know, heavier than air machines fly. And it's only been the last, couple 300 years that we've actually been able to get in the air with balloons and other sorts of, you know, lighter than air, as we call them, craft. So it's been very recent that humans could fly, and all sorts of mythology associated with that. But this Raven came from the spirit world and was kind of bored with all the other birds. Raven being very smart, again, he got bored with the other birds, the bird brains, and is just kind of carrying this rock around, you know, and flew away from spirit land or bird land, as it were, and came to this big water area and just dropped this pebble, and it became the land. And that's where the earth came from, and some of the creation stories of some of the people in the Northwest. So Raven actually created that. Ravens are, as I mentioned, being tricksters. A lot of great stories about ravens and, you know, trying to get the best of humans. And in fact, in some of the Northwest indigenous people's stories, and if you look at their not only in their stories, but in their art, Raven plays a very, very prominent role in a lot of the wood carvings. Of course, Raven plays an extremely prominent role there. But the interesting thing about its cousin, we're talking about actually close cousins here, ravens and crows. Raven, in the trickster stories, was tended to be very malevolent. And there's in some other stories, you know, there's also some other malevolent sorts of beings, and Coyote was as well. But Raven tended to be kind of malevolent. But Crow, on the other hand, tended to be a little bit more concerned about justice. So some of the bad things that Raven did were undone by Crow. And there's also lots of stories of interactions between Crow and Raven, and both being very intelligent birds. And for some reason, Crow got the kind of was the good part of the corvids, and ravens sort of the bad. Interesting in some of those stories, if we can divide them in such an easy way as that. But it isn't just limited. The stories of ravens and crows aren't just limited, and these other corvids too, you know, history here. There's I did a little research, Will. There's stories about ravens in Australia. Amazing, among the native people there. And on our own history, and I didn't realize ravens went that far south, but apparently there are maybe a different species, but there is a raven in the south. Another thing that seems to be universal is that there's stories of, and maybe you can comment on this, that ravens and crows at one time, or especially ravens, weren't black, they were white. And there's stories in North American cultures of how raven got black, and there are also stories in European cultures of that raven was really white at one time.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Gary. And just to let folks know, they really do have a worldwide range, not just circumpolar or just even in the northern hemisphere, but they're worldwide.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Cosmopolitan species, they call it.
And so it's the same species. Interesting.
Yeah, they have very little variation.
Interesting.
They've noticed that's one thing that biologists have noticed about the corvids, that within each species there seems to be very little variation. A lot of smaller birds or other bird species, you see a lot of different subspecies.
Mm-hmm.
Ravens don't have any distinct subspecies differences. They might have one or two races, but the differences can only be noticed if you have a bird in the hand. That's how subtle they are. But back to the what you mentioned about the raven being white and changed to black, that really caught my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I read a little bit about the explorations of the Russians into into Alaska and Canada, and Vitus Bering, and on one of his expeditions, he mentions seeing a white raven, and I've never seen it mentioned anywhere else. He also mentioned seeing a northern Pacific sea cow. They call it stellar sea cow.
Mm-hmm.
That has never been seen other than by him, or never recorded again. Supposedly similar to the manatee of the Atlantic, but this white raven is recorded in Bering's journals, and seeing it on a stormy day on the boat, and it came into view and out of view just as quickly.
Wow!
Never seen again. So who knows?
Who knows? Very interesting. And I wonder, are there any records of albinism among ravens? Does that happen?
I don't know if there's any records of albinism. I haven't seen any. It wouldn't surprise me if there are, but I do know that there occasionally you'll see a corvid, a crow, or a raven with a few pale feathers. They seem to typically be in breast or wing feathers.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there other species, Will, of ravens other than the one that we find?
There are.
Throughout the world? I mean, we know there's a few different species of crows that are a little bit different, but this is amazing because the parallels with humans are, because human beings are pretty much, although we make a big deal out of differences between different human types, we're pretty much essentially, when we look at our genetics, we don't have much variation at all.
No, in fact, there's more genetic variation. I read this journal article a few years back that there's more genetic diversity within the continent of Africa than there is between folks from the continent of Africa compared to, say, Anglo
uh-huh.
Folks. But yeah, that's an interesting question, Gary. There's another raven species in North America, the Chihuahuan raven.
Oh, okay.
And they seem to be separated by habitat. Chihuahuan raven traditionally has been more tolerant of drought-like conditions, the arid climates of up into Texas, but mostly Mexico.
Okay.
And it's commonly known in the birding world, if you're a traveling birder and look for different species of birds, mm-hmm. to observe. The Chihuahuan ravens can be routinely seen in Texas at the Brownsville dump.
Wow.
And that's just another testament to their intelligence. They mm-hmm. they are very good at tearing apart garbage bags.
Okay.
But yeah, the Chihuahuan raven is another species. Both Corvus, genus Corvus, the common raven's scientific name is Corvus corax.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are three species of crows in North America as well.
Oh, are they also Corvus genus?
They're all Corvus, all okay. five.
So all somewhat close, same,
yeah.
all in the same genus.
And amazing. It's interesting that you mentioned Australia earlier, because there are an incredible number of corvids there.
Wow.
As well, and it's thought by taxonomists that corvids may have originated in Australasia.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, this is good, Gary. Should we take a break?
Well, let's take a quick musical break and come back a little bit more on some of the history. I've got a little bit here about some of the history from Europe, and Eurasia. We'll be right back.
track.
Yeah.
That was that high-flying trumpet there is Maynard Ferguson.
Wow.
Good grief. He really gets up there.
He does. That's an amazing piece.
Okay. Well, welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. Talking about Ravens.
Ravens, another Corvids. A little bit of history in the old world, where many people that live in North America are from, in the United States. Or at least their ancestors are from there. Oh. Talked about ravens being tricksters here in North, among the indigenous North American people. They're also they're kind of prophets, harbingers of death in the old world as well. You know, of course, everybody's heard the poem by Edgar Allan Poe, The Raven, and that talks a little bit about that. But it's interesting, in some of the Germanic mythology, Odin had two ravens, Hugin and Munin. The first was thought, and the second was memory. And these two ravens would fly around the world, or the worlds. There were kind of nine different worlds in Norse mythology, and come back and tell Odin what was going on, so to speak. And there's actually, in one of the Eddas, the stories that have been preserved in Iceland and elsewhere for years. I mean, this written history goes back thousands or more years. It tells a story about how Odin said he's really worried about thought, but he's even more worried about losing memory. So it's really kind of an interesting comment on us as well. And also the ravens were implicated in battlefield deaths in Germanic tradition. The Valkyrs, who were these women that kind of took the heroes into heaven and decided who would live and who would die on the battlefield. They would use, I think, raven wings to come down and get in front of the eyes and sort of make the battle, turn the battle one way or the other in the eyes of the individual fighters out there, the individual warriors. Kind of an interesting take on it. In the Celtic mythology, also stories of raven and Morrigan is more in the Welsh end of things. Morrigan in the Irish and the Scottish tradition was a female deity, a goddess who kind of had three different incarnations, all of them as ravens. And the great Irish hero Cuchulain was, when he died, in fact, she foretold his death by washing his clothes. And there's a tradition in a lot of Northern Europeans that the fates wash the clothes of somebody, and when they do that beforehand, then you're going to die in the battle. And so she sat on his shoulder when he had died, and rather interesting. And in Scotland, in Gaelic, they have a term that the of an old, she usually appears in the form of an old woman. And even today, in kind of local legend, they keep ravens in the Tower of London. And there's, I guess, some local legend that if the ravens ever leave the Tower of London, then England will fall or something like that. So they keep ravens in the Tower of London all the time. At least that's reportedly. I've never been there, Will. So that's kind of interesting. If somebody's been to the Tower of London, maybe that's I understand they're still, they have some ravens and they clip some wings of them. There's like, wow, these captive ravens in the Tower of London. Didn't know that. Kind of like pet ravens.
Yeah, let us know about that.
If anybody knows that, well, maybe we can report on that. So interesting history, and all the way in Greek mythology as well. There's stories about ravens, and of course ravens at one time being white and foretelling the future, prophesying. So it goes back all throughout the old world as well, the interaction between humans and raven.
Interesting bird, the raven. And as we mentioned earlier, incredibly opportunistic feeder, an omnivore like us, and known to eat all manner of vegetable and animal matter, from grasshoppers to lizards to dead, to carrion, dead mammals, any type of grains, as well as trash, sorting through trash to find food there. An interesting note, I think, that I didn't mention earlier about A difference, a noticeable difference between crows and ravens is in their flight. If you notice, a crow has to flap an awful lot. You see birds in flight, especially if you've seen raptors in flight, large raptors. You can just tell by the way they fly that they have very powerful wings. Their strokes are few. And rather long in between strokes, and the distance they travel between strokes is pretty impressive. And the way their wings flap all the way through, top to bottom, you can tell that they're rather strong flyers as well. Crows don't fly like that at all. They flap their wings constantly, and if you see a crow in a windstorm, they look pretty pathetic. Ravens, on the other hand, do an awful lot of soaring.
Oh yeah,
they have slotted wings or slotted primary feathers, meaning that there's a pretty good gap in space between the primary feathers, which gives them a lot of uplift. Just like Buteos, the soaring raptors, soaring hawks, and so seeing a raven in flight, their flight is more powerful, and you tend to see them do a lot of soaring in between strokes as well. So another way to kind of tell if that corvid over there is a raven or a crow. One other interesting thing I wanted to mention, a couple interesting other facts real quick on ravens before we wrap up on ravens and move on to our whopper of the week. We got a good one this week. Gary found a good one. They tend to mob other raptors, or not other raptors, they are not a raptor, but raptors. Crows and ravens tend to do mobbing, where they will surround a hawk or an owl and just terrorize them. They will just terrorize these poor raptors until the raptors move on. And they do that in mostly as kind of an offensive way to keep them away from their nests. Mm-hmm. They know that, they can perceive that these birds are a threat to reproductive success, and so they tend to mob. One of the most interesting photographs I've ever seen is of a raven mobbing a California condor, and it's looking up, mm-hmm. and you can see the bottom side of the condor, and the raven maybe takes up 5 to 10% of that condor's body size. It's the most amazing photograph.
Wow.
So this mobbing tendency, just kind of alert tendency, and other members of the family do it too. Magpies and jays are members of the corvidae, and they tend to do an awful lot of mobbing. And if you spend time in the woods, they tend to make your presence known. Unfortunately, sometimes
yes.
you're trying to be a little more secretive. And the last interesting piece of ecology or natural history on ravens that I want to mention is that they're pretty protective of their breeding territory in the spring and summer. They don't allow other ravens to enter that, but they are communal roosters when they're not breeding. And in these communal roosting sites, scientists have often used those to study the species more closely, and they found that ravens tend to cough up pellets just like a lot of other raptors do.
Wow, I didn't realize
so,
that.
So another way to study the food habits of this harbinger of death.
Mm-hmm.
Through their pellets.
Very interesting, Will. Oh, and I wondered if mobbing is also used against other raptors and ravens by smaller birds. I've noticed, particularly among the blackbirds, I guess the icterids, is that the...
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that they will mob, too, especially if there's a raven or a crow or a hawk, and they will chase them, you know, and they'll be flying around them.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
you know, that kind of mobbing behavior. Mm. Behavior. So that's a rather interesting, I guess, again, you say it's an offensive way, you know, kind of the best defense is a good offense.
Right, exactly.
Using from a sports terminology there. So quite fascinating. Well, Will, are we about ready?
I think it's time.
All right, a little drumming here. Yeah, it's that time of the week for the Whopper.
The Whopper.
The Whopper of the week.
Whopper.
Well, this Whopper caught my attention by the ridiculous title that I saw in the newspaper. I'd been told of it by some other people, said, you have to read this article. It's the craziest thing I'd ever heard about. And so we're giving a little background here. Well, one of the rarest mammals we've talked about, wolverines and others, but one of the rarest mammals in the lower 48 happens to be the big bear, the great bear, the big brown bear, the grizz. And there's been a big fight here on the Idaho-Montana border up north, more in the panhandle country, about in the cabinet yak ecosystem, Selkirk cabinet yak ecosystem. There's only maybe 30 to 40 bears, grizzlies left there. And they're trying to protect their habitat. And there's a proposed mine for inside the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness. Actually, the mine would have some, they would try to mine under the wilderness, but I still think they would have some surface disturbance within the wilderness. Well, amazingly, there's a title that says, Fish and Wildlife Service says mine in Montana would benefit grizzlies. Now, anybody that knows anything about grizzly bears knows that a mine isn't going to help the grizzlies. And nor is it going to help the other threatened species up there, bull trout, which need cold, clean
water.
Clean, the emphasis on clean water. But what they're claiming, you read this and it's just ridiculous, is what they're claiming is that, well, because we're going to require the mining company to do some, quote, mitigation, buy some land, that actually it's going to be a net benefit for grizzlies. This is kind of what we call palliative or mitigative management, and really doesn't seem to work very well for most species. And it's sort of, well, if we do this good thing here, let's do something there. Well, maybe the best example here in the wild Clearwater country of this kind of management is the problem we're having with elk up in the upper Clearwater as in terms of winter range. Some winters you'll have big die-offs because they don't have the lower elevation country, which is now covered up by Dvorak Reservoir, what they used to go into. And we quote, we've mitigated that by putting elk in and buying habitat in Craig Mountain, long ways away. But that really do any good? It may have done well for the elk around Craig Mountain, but it didn't help the herd in the Clearwater. And I think that's, you know, anytime we try to do this, quote, mitigation kind of stuff, we're, you know, this one step forward, one step back sort of thing, really, it's really questionable whether or not we're actually going to have more benefits than not.
Yeah, I think it's definitely at least a step and a quarter back.
Yeah, I would. That's what I would think. So anyway, the Fish and Wildlife Service claims that because of this now they have a new biological evaluation because of a court case that says, oh, it's going to even be better for grizzlies, bear.
And we should just mine the whole Northern Rockies.
Rockies, and then we'll have grizzly bears everywhere. Right. Exactly. Brilliant. That's sort of what this is saying. I don't know what to say. It's the most ridiculous. It's the most counterintuitive thing that anybody could imagine. And, in fact, somebody in the mining said something also equally ridiculous. Revit Mining, this company that wants to do this, said, any group that appeals this biological opinion will therefore be putting the grizzly population bear at further risk. That is ridiculous.
Wow.
It's not a further risk. They're going to actually protect the habitat. They're going to screw up. So I think, Will, because of such a stupid, misleading, and absolutely false statement.
Yes.
I mean, mitigation might be good, but they could go out and let's do mitigation for these bears. Anyway, this is an imperiled population. They're actually declining in number. They have to bring in breeding females because of the concern. They're actually going to bring, I think, a couple from around Glacier just because of the concern over the loss of grizzlies in the cabinet yak, and they've actually brought some in the past, in the last 10 years, and those numbers are still going down. Because of that, I think the Fish and Wildlife Service and Revit Mining deserve this joint whopper
of the week.
There we go.
Yeah, with a good portion of heavy metals and radioactive
heavy metals and waste. Lead and cadmium there.
Good grief. Well, that's about all we got. A quick reminder, the doubleheader, fantastic fundraiser weekend coming up Friday night is Radio Free Moscow's second birthday party the 1912. And on Saturday night will be a benefit show for Friends of the Clearwater.
All right.
At the American Legion Hall.